The curse of the devil. Exorcism or sacrifice. Blessing or bestiality.
Hello and welcome to episode 35 of the Nashy Cast, the podcast about the films of Paul Nashy. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And I'm struggling to not do the Shatner thing again.
probably tough to you after.
I know. This is I am Kirok. But I won't want to do that anymore. I've been watching some older television lately. Maybe that's what's doing it. Yeah. There's a certain style of acting.
Mm-hmm.
That I actually absolutely love.
Right.
I have been watching some season one episodes of The $6 Million Man.
Oh, good stuff. Good choice.
But you know, I go back and I watch episodes of, I'm trying to slowly but surely work my way through Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I never saw as a kid.
Right.
But, God, we are off track and I haven't even tried. Mm-hmm. I've got a cat trying to get in my lap and we are here to talk to you tonight about a movie called The Sniper.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 35 takes us back to the 70s, 1978, into a film that...
this is Nashy getting in trouble again. This is Nashy being a naughty boy, you know.
yeah, but well...
Stirring things up.
On screen and off.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
very much so. This is a very interesting film. Once again, this is one that neither of us had seen until we decided to do it for the podcast.
Right.
And bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
Didn't really know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
Had heard some positive things about it, and it's kind of an interesting turn of events.
Yes, it is.
I think it's interesting. You've already alluded to it, but it is a film that caused Nashy some trouble,
mm-hmm.
mainly because a lot of people saw it as a political film, and I guess to a degree it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we should point out that The Sniper is a film about a man who intends to assassinate a public figure.
Mm-hmm.
This film was made only a couple of years after that particular public figure had died.
Right.
And so, not that I'm trying to be coy or anything, I'm just trying to save some discussion points for the film, when we actually get into the film.
Right.
But it apparently did cause him some grief, the making of this. It caused him some trouble in his home country.
Mm-hmm.
And so, once again, this is a film that's very hard to locate. It's going to be very difficult to find you a copy of it. It is possible out there if you have the special antenna.
Yeah. The one that grows out of your backside.
Oh my God, a South Park reference. Is that?
Yeah.
I haven't had a South Park reference in forever. This is a film worth seeking out. It is not a film that I think ever had an English dub, or really I think it's one that probably was ever intended to play much outside of Spain or of Europe, maybe at the largest.
It's not very exploitable, let's put it that way. The ballyhoo, as they would say, the ballyhoo elements of this for that the driving circuit could have used are not much. They would have, they're not, I mean, other than there's some nudity, but, you know.
Yeah, there's some glorious nudity.
Other than that, there's you know, they would have had to just focused on that and called it, you know, shacked up in Spain or something like that, you know.
Shacked up in Madrid.
Yeah, might have gotten some play, but otherwise... naked. Well, we've already had Naked Madrid. You'd be like,
I was about to
Sinful Madrid.
Sinful Madrid. I mean, what do they draw attention to the May December romance element? I mean,
yeah, exactly. I know. You know, all I can see it now would be Last Tango in Spain. You know,
with cigars instead of odd food items. Oh, well, I will start off by saying that in Nashy's own words, I, of course, as often as I can, I like to go back to what he actually had to say about his films.
Mm-hmm.
And with this one, in that issue of videos when he was talking about each and every one of his movies, what he had to say about this was that he says it's a film of the very worst memories for me. Mm-hmm. I received death threats for months because of this film. It made my life so impossible that I had to send my wife and my sons to Argelia
mm-hmm.
because I thought I was going to be killed. The film provoked someone to shoot a spectator in Barcelona. It was a very difficult time to make this type of cinema. It's a worthy film, in my opinion, even though it may have been a damned film. That's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And I can see how even looking at the film and thinking it's a good movie, if you're in Nashy's position, looking at it and thinking it's a good film, for it to have caused that much mm-hmm. trouble in his life, at the time he was speaking about these movies, it was a good 15 or so years after the fact. So I'm guessing he was able to get a little mm-hmm. distance from it and therefore be able to kind of speak to it without that much emotion getting in the way of him thinking about whether the film was worthy or not, as he puts it. Mm-hmm. But that can't be easy.
Yeah. No, no, no. Well, you know, it's like we said before in the show. I mean, they take their politics very seriously in Spain.
Yes,
you know,
well,
and they're you know, both sides. You know, it's not always a matter that people approach with sanity. and for him to, you know, for him to make a film like this was, yeah, definitely taking a risk.
Not the only risk he took in the late 70s either.
No, no.
I mean, he made very soon after this, or was it before this, he made the film The Transsexual.
After it. I was going to say, he actually made three films in a row that apparently caused a controversy. I can't remember what the one he made right before this one was, but that apparently was, as he says in his biography, apparently that was a very touchy subject. Maybe something similar to, I think it also had to deal with possibly an assassination of a public figure, but either way, it was touchy. This film was, and then he made The Transsexual, which also apparently caused riots in theaters. So he basically made...
Oh, you're thinking about Death of a President.
Yes, yes, that one.
Yeah.
So he basically made, for suddenly in a string of films here, he suddenly was this, you know, kind of transgressive, you know, or just socially conscious filmmaker, you know. And again, I think that part of what gets him in trouble, as we'll see with this film, is he doesn't necessarily take sides very strong. You know, he does to a point, but it's subtle. It's very subtle the way he does it. And it's very, you know, and his films are not necessarily, they don't necessarily play favorites, and that probably gets him in trouble with everybody. So, if you try to please nobody, you end up pleasing nobody. And that's,
Or if you, well, and sometimes if you try to please everybody, you pretty much please no one.
So that's
part of it as well. So tonight's film is The Sniper from 1978. We'll take a quick break, come back here in just a second. We'd like to remind you that if you'd like to get in contact with us, you can drop us an email at nashycast@gmail.com. You can join us over on the Facebook page, the Nashycast Facebook page. Join us there anytime.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to post the many faces of Paul Nashy on there.
Yeah, I've enjoyed that.
Every couple of days, I put up an image of Nashy in one bit of makeup or another. Maybe just different facial hair or wigs. So, it all depends.
Sometimes several in one film, you know, several in...
Oh, yeah, tell me about it. So drop us a line if you'd like to get involved in the discussion here. Any comments on the podcast, on the films we talk about, on Paul Nashy, on Spanish horror, anything along those lines. Drop us a line at nashycast@gmail.com, and we will be glad to hear from you. Right now, we'll take a break and come right back at you.
So, the film starts with a quote from Baudelaire, and that has Nashy written all over it, although this film was written, actually, Nashy co-wrote it with apparently two other people, so we don't know that this was Nashy, but if you see a quote from Baudelaire, that really makes you think it's Nashy. The quote is, "Free man, you will always cherish the sea."
Correct.
Which comes into play, definitely, as part of the thematically within the film.
Agreed.
We get past the kind of stately opening credits with a bust of Franco there.
And that would be General Franco. Mm-hmm. Generalissimo Franco, that would be the dictatorial fascist ruler of Spain for decades, from the mid-20s till he passed away in 1975.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you something, because you watched Saturday Night Live in its early classic days, right?
Yeah, of course.
Do you remember the thing they used to do? And, of course, me being so little, I never got what they, you know. Do you remember the little running joke they had about Franco, of Generalissimo Franco, that they kept doing a weekend update, where they'd say, "This just in, General Franco," or Generalissimo Franco, whatever it is they called him, and I said, "It's still alive," you know, and they would keep, and they would do that every now and then, on weekend update.
I do remember that.
And at the time, I had no idea who Franco was, but I wondered if it was because, you know, as we'll see later as we get into some of the help we've gotten from Elena on this film, you know, definitely a lot. There were a lot of attempts to assassinate Franco.
There were quite a few.
There might have even been times when the rumor got out that he was assassinated or whatever. Maybe that was part of the joke, just the fact that everybody wanted him dead. I don't know, but I always remember on the early classic Saturday Night Live them making this continual joke about Franco is still alive kind of thing. They do every now and then. So anyway, that's just an aside. I don't know if you remembered that or not.
Okay, I do remember it. Mm. About the opening credits, it's they play over a bust of Franco, mm-hmm. which is interesting. But one thing about the credits that I wanted to point out is that the final credit in the opening credits is written for the screen and directed by, and then the director's name. It's not until the very end when we get another written by credit where someone other than the director is credited with the screenplay.
And it's Jacinto Molina, Paul Naschy, and two other guys.
Right.
Yeah, that is very interesting.
And what was funny is that as soon as I noticed that, I thought, oh, well, then is our information on IMDb and a couple of other places incorrect? But like I say, the credit at the beginning only credits the director as a writer, but the very first final, you know, the very first credit at the end of the film says differently, says that there are three people credited at the end. So I thought that was interesting. So I think that thereby hangs a tale if we were to ever get it, but who knows?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'd love to know how that transpired, who wrote what, you know, how that ended up happening. Oh, I definitely. So after the credits, we're basically brought into a clock repair shop, is what we, as far as we tell this is a clock repair shop. Yeah. We see the clock repairman, who is Lucas, played by Paul Naschy.
And let's get this out of the way right now. He plays, Naschy's the main character, Lucas. He's a watch repairman, a clockmaker, watchmaker. Mm-hmm. He's a widower. Mm-hmm. His wife has apparently been dead for a couple of years. And he has a young daughter. Mm-hmm. Our very first scene, we are introduced to him, and he is hugging his daughter, sending her off to school that morning, as they apparently do every morning. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that impressed me was that is his real hair.
I knew you were going to say that. Naschy is going wigless in this, and let's talk about why. Why would he be going wigless? Why would he make that decision
here? He wants to look like a normal person.
Every man.
Exactly. This is an every man.
He's not playing the chick magnet.
Right. Yeah. He's playing the every man. He's playing a man in middle age who has lost his wife and is now a single parent. And you can see the very receding hairline. You can see the bald spot on the top there. He's got the crown. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to see him, you know, look this way. And it's nice that he looked this way for this role, that he, you know, that decision was made. Well, I love the fact that in his conversation with his daughter there, before she goes off to school, the takeaway from it is the line he delivers as he's talking to her. He says, "A promise is a debt," and he's saying this to her. It's obvious that this is something he wants to teach to his daughter, and he's doing it in a very sweet way. But I think that line right there, that's your introduction to that character.
Yeah, it is.
A promise is a debt. That's nice.
Yeah. And it's obvious pretty quickly that this girl is the center. His daughter is the center of his, you know, his life. You know, and I thought it was interesting when we get the first, before we even see him, and we're panning through his shop, and there's the photos on the you know, the framed photos. One of his wife. There's one of him as a body, you know, as a bodybuilder.
As a weightlifter, yeah.
And I think it may actually be from the film he made directly before this, because if you look in his biography, the film The Assassination of the President, he apparently plays a. I think a logger or something in that.
I don't know.
But it shows a picture from the film, and it looks like he's at a weightlifting competition, and it says it's from that movie, and this picture looks very similar to one that might have been taken from that same session. But that's really the only thing at all that we see from Lucas's earlier life. You know, because the way this character's played, we get a lot of interesting little hints. Or it makes, you know, we wonder a lot of times kind of what his background is, some of the things he does. But this is the only picture we really see is that he used, actually. I thought it was interesting that Naschy used one of the photos of himself as a weightlifter, you know, which was his real life profession before he got into to filmmaking.
Well, we watch his daughter walk on her walk to school. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting. This is a neat cinematic thing. As she goes off, As she leaves the shop to go to walk to school, Nashie's character gets back to his work there at his storefront, mm-hmm. and turns on the radio. Mm-hmm. And at first it's a news program, but he switches it over to some music, mm-hmm. and we hear the radio over watching the daughter walk to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was an interesting choice because it. Just cinematically, it draws you in because you're immediately aware. Oh, that's interesting. He's directly tying
mm-hmm.
the father at work, you know, in his shop working to mm-hmm. the young daughter going to school, and I wonder why. And then very quickly we find out why.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is that
because the radio thing has been talking about how the dictator Franco is going fishing. You know, that's basically you know mm-hmm. basically the his every you know this is
right. That's apparently that was. Franco's major
mm-hmm.
relaxation thing that he did mm-hmm. that he did all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, the daughter is walking to school, and some very official looking cars that are obviously government cars. We don't know who are in the cars, but the implication is that it's either Franco or some other high up person in his administration,
right?
Some government official. And a bomb goes off in the street, causing these cars to swerve, and one of the cars swerves directly off of the road and strikes the girl, and mm-hmm. of course kills her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A nearby spectator rushes back to the shop to weepingly tell Lucas what has happened. Lucas rushes out, and that is a pretty devastating scene to see. I mean, it's. Yeah. Even though we've only just within a few minutes been introduced to these characters, the anguish there. I mean, anybody can identify with the pain of loss if you're old enough to have grieved.
Yeah,
and that is a pretty harsh scene.
It is very well played by Nashie and very painful scene.
It's very well done, and I was kind of impressed how we see him there clutching his daughter's body on the street, and the camera pans up away from him. And the scene plays just a few seconds longer, almost as if this is a little too painful to watch
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
any longer.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was kind of nice. From there, we go to the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a quiet little funeral. We see the end of it.
Yeah, it's just kind of shot. The whole thing is shot from a distance. You never hear the words people say. You just kind of see them all sort of saying their goodbye, their last condolences to Nashie as he's left standing alone over the grave.
And directly after the funeral, he goes out to he walks out to a nearby park, and is standing there, obviously in just terrible grief. And he's looking at this thing carved into the side of a tree, which apparently has some specific significance between him and his wife
and the daughter. Because the daughter, she said. And then the first scene, one of the things she says is, "Are we going to go see Mama's tree?"
Right.
Yeah. We never see what was carved in there, but it's obviously probably something where he and his wife had carved, like, you know, their love, or you know, they made the, you know, carved something themselves in the tree.
Yep. And I do actually wish we'd gotten a good look at what was carved into the tree.
Yeah.
Not because I think it would have told us something we don't know from the film already, but just because that little detail would be nice to have. It would add just a little bit, but it's not mm-hmm. necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But while he's doing this, he's accosted by some bodyguards of General Franco, who mess with him a bit until one of them recognizes him and says, no, he's a local. I know him. He's the watchmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is Franco is just nearby fishing.
Right.
And we get some actually pretty well incorporated stock footage of Franco fly fishing off of the riverside.
Right.
It looks like it fits in here pretty well. It
does very well, yeah.
As a matter of fact, throughout the film, there's a good deal of use of stock footage of various parades and of General mm-hmm. Franco that are very well integrated.
Yeah.
They're very well done. I mean, you know that these were not shot for use in this film, that they're mm-hmm. appropriating this stuff and using it.
Mm-hmm.
But, it, you know, pretty much every case, it works very effectively. It really does. They've worked very hard to match the footage and mm-hmm. shoot it in such a way that it actually fits. Mm-hmm. So
I think so, too. I think I like the way... And this scene is just, you know, again... The kind of just the way they basically talk to Nashie like he's a bum, you know, basically. I mean, it just kind of shows that bullying sort of attitude of Franco's regime there, you know, and these soldiers' regimes. Even once they recognize who he is, they still are like just, you know, basically like shooing him off, like, you know, and that's, you know, that's pretty
powerful to
watch.
I think it's important to remember, for those who don't know, Franco's regime was a fascist regime.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
much like the Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm.
Very right wing, mm-hmm. totalitarian.
A lot of militaristic showmanship kind of stuff going on.
Exactly,
there.
Exactly. And
military theater, you know.
Good point, military theater, because mm-hmm. we as the film goes on, we get introduced to just how regimented and structured the mm-hmm. the military theater is in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, next, after being run out of the park, essentially, he goes back to his shop and we see an explosion of rage from Lucas here, mm-hmm, where he mm-hmm. picks up a small hand axe and just beats the hell out of the wall and breaks a couple of clocks that are hanging mm-hmm. on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
He goes down to the basement, opens up this old trunk. In the trunk are a couple of toys. It looked like they probably were possessions of his wife's that he's kept.
Yeah,
and also in there, what he unwraps is a pistol.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's clear that something is definitely on his mind.
And it's interesting that this is kind of the last real... When he smashes his shop is the last real explosion of rage we see from him in the film.
Yes.
Because from that point to point, he unpacks the gun, he becomes a focused man again. He has a purpose.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting, just that whole unwrapping of the gun asks all these questions about his past, you know, and the way he starts to go about what he's going to do. Start to make you wonder, you know, what his background and where he, you know, once he starts.
We never know. Did he have a military background? Mm. Although it looks very probable.
Yeah,
you know, there are a lot of things that we don't know for sure. Mm. And later on, I think we do get one more visual hint about his background, but we'll get to that.
Okay.
He takes a train trip to Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
He's on a train car. This is labeled, by the way, from here on, we start getting dates put up on the screen.
Yes, ma'am.
And this is March the 24th.
Mm-hmm.
He's taking a train trip to Madrid. And when they come around to check papers, he looks very nervous. Hands over his papers. There are no mm-hmm. problems. But that nervousness, the fact that he kind of shifts his bag, his mm-hmm. bag to one side of himself, kind of makes you realize he's probably got the pistol with him and just doesn't want to be searched.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, he gets to Madrid, goes to a hostel to procure a room.
Mm-hmm.
He's shown a room, he decides to take it, and let's just go ahead and introduce all the various characters that are here. There's Santiago, who's kind of the...
Dirty old man.
No, I'm sorry.
You're right. Santiago's the maid.
Yeah, the maid or cleaning lady and cook and mm-hmm. kind of an all-around servant. We have Flora, who's the owner of the place.
Right.
Flora would be a middle-aged woman. She's a widower.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm sorry, she's a widow.
Mm-hmm.
And Santiago is a fairly attractive, I would say, redheaded woman of about 30 or something. Familiar one to us, too. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. let it rip.
Yeah, Eva Leon.
Yes, of course.
Eva Leon. Yeah, it's good to see her again.
Always good to see you.
It is.
Well, he decides to take a room here.
Mm-hmm.
After he takes this room, we have our first scene that gives us a hint of where his thoughts are turning, which is that he's lying there on a bed, and we have this overlay of images of General Franco, and it's clear that that's what's on his mind. Well, at dinner that night, his first dinner in this place, this kind of boarding house,
mm-hmm.
is a dinner. It's dinner with all the other guests, and. From what I can tell, these guests are really kind of a cross section of a lot of specific types of people in Spain at the time. You've got kind of the old conservative, the old fascist guy who
Rafael. He's the older conservative. Yeah,
you got a young college radical who's obviously
Alfonso,
who's obviously the left wing or liberal guy.
Mm-hmm.
You've got kind of an old. Old dotard, the guy.
Yeah,
who
here's the dirty old man.
He's the
Gonzalito,
dirty old man.
Gonzalito, the man in the exactly. And he's the one who's kind of basically always trying to call the radical conservative to just stop arguing, eat supper, and just he's more of the practical. He's more the man of the instant gratification needs. Feeling up the maid, and
I'd call him the centrist. Can't we all just get along?
Yeah,
Let me grope Eva Leon and have some soup.
Exactly.
He's constantly throughout the film just asking, can we just stop? Can we just not argue? And to be honest, the fact that they're arguing over dinner makes you want to just slap them anyway. So you kind of agree with him.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And it does look like that as the film goes on, not only does the older dirty old man have a thing for Santiago, but so does the young college radical. I mean, but then who couldn't?
Right, exactly, yeah. Oh, yeah, because first thing you notice is that she's making her way around the table give everybody their soup. The, you know, Gonzalito, give, you know, fills her up there, you know. And but later the young guy does the same thing. And
well, the next thing we see is we see Lucas in his room. He's hunched over and he's using his watchmaking magnifying glass to study maps of Madrid, of the city. And he's mapping out distances. He's timing certain things. He's looking things over. And we also notice, if you pay attention, that while he's doing this, someone is watching him as he's doing this.
Yeah.
We see him walking around Madrid, looking over different streets, kind of carefully planning something. He's going by. He's going through his maps.
He's kind of outside a big arena, and you know, he's walking around and looking at. Yeah, but you're right. We see this scene where somebody's taking photos, and they very obviously turn. And take a photo of him that he never sees.
Right, right. The next time we see him in his room, he's got the gun out. It looks like he's been cleaning it, and he points at the date on the calendar of May the 1st, which means the man wanted to desperately celebrate my birthday.
He did. I thought about that. I thought about that. It's like that's a visual. He was doing a visual shout out to the bloody pit. That's right.
That's right, buddy. Well, at this point, he's actually interrupted in the room by Santiago, who wants to come in and make the bed and clean the place
up. Interrupt is right. She just sort of barges in.
Yeah, and he rushes her out of there, and he realizes he needs a hiding place for the gun.
Yeah.
So he pries up a floorboard under his desk in his room, digs out the insulation under there, and stashes the pistol down there so that at least he's out of the way, and nobody's going to discover that he's got a gun in his room.
Right.
Then he goes into the bathroom, and I got a question for you: what the hell is it that he catches Santiago and the dirty old man doing?
As far as I can tell. Speaking as someone who will be a dirty old man within a few years myself, I think what he is doing is he's giving her money to, like, basically let him, like, look at her crotch or stick his hand down her crotch or something is kind of what I'm gathered from that. Like, you know, is he's just sort of like...
Is that it? You think this... Okay. That makes sense.
Sort of what... Because she's got her skirt up and he looks like... He looked almost like
he's looking down her pantyhose.
Yeah. And I think he's... And I almost... Doesn't he give her, like, a little money or something? Doesn't she, like, take out of his hand?
I couldn't tell if that was money or not.
I thought that I did. No. But I think that's
generally kind of... It would make sense.
If that was what I do. Regardless, I think basically, you know, she's giving him a thrill, you know, there. Well, I guess And
well, what's funny is that they get embarrassed and they leave.
yeah.
Then Nashy leaves. But as he's leaving, the old fascist comes in.
Yeah.
And we see him dyeing his mustache.
Yeah.
Treating his mustache so he looks younger than he actually is, which I thought. No. So we're kind of just getting
Well, this movie really makes the most of this little, I mean, it's I love these little characters and this little world it portrays here, because I think it's in great contrast. If these are just, you know, these are the people of, you know, I mean, they're all just sort of co-inhabiting this, you know, this little world, you know, and they're all eccentric and got their weird, you know,
I mean,
it's like, it's one of those things where I was sitting there watching, I was thinking, I think I could just watch a movie about what goes on in this boarding house. I think it really just turns this thing that was just kind of a stopover for his character and made it just a whole very interesting little movie within itself, a little story within itself here.
Well, I think what's funny is that he doesn't even stay in the boarding house on screen. He doesn't stay there much longer than he needs to.
Right.
But at the same time, we get just enough of each one of these characters to get a real sense of who or what they are and what, you know, what kind of is behind them in a certain way, what their thought processes are. And it's all done in very, I mean, there's a good bit of dialogue between different characters, but that's not really where you get the vast majority of the stuff that you're getting. You get it in stuff like seeing him, you know, surreptitiously dyeing his mustache this weird little bizarre sexual semi-sexual odd thing between these two characters. It's just,
and the way their world resolves around that television, that's still kind of where their nights are spent, the dinner table and the television, watching the television, watching the footage of the parade, you know, the old conservative reminiscing about days past, parades past, you know. And we haven't even gotten into what was her name again, the landlady, the one,
Flora.
This whole interesting thing about the fact that Nashi's name is the same as her dead husband.
Yeah.
And Nashi is not moved at all about this. Lucas isn't, because he's got his own thing to, you know. But that whole scene where she kind of just talks about... I mean, it's obvious they really do a lot to convey her loneliness without getting too just heavy-handed with
it. Well, it never becomes
No, it doesn't. Yeah. But it's just obvious from how much she talks about him and goes on and on about Nashi about Lucas having the same name as, you know, it's just this guy. It's that. And then when, well, you know, later on when he, you know, when he's not staying there anymore, the last thing we see from her, she says, Lucas is truly gone now. You know, it's kind of like him leaving, you know, you sense her loneliness. Yeah. And she just loved having somebody there by that name that she could call that name there. And it's a neat little effective character sort of thing.
I kept expecting there to be some kind of attempt on her part to initiate some kind of closer relationship with Lucas. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't. At least we don't see her try to do that. I wonder if there was originally the idea to have something like that in the movie, and it's and they just decided to leave it out or not. But at any rate, it's still very effective in that it gives you that, like I say, it's just another little insight into her character and what drives her.
Right.
But like I said, we see at one night at dinner, Lucas asks the older perverted old man.
Right.
If he knows of a photographer, a discreet photographer in here, the young radical overhears him and comes to him later while he's shaving and says, look, if you're looking for a quote-unquote discreet photographer, go to this guy named Moses Exposito, and he can probably help you out with whatever it is that you need.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucas asks him, well, thank you very much. You know, thank you, but why are you doing this? And very cryptically, the young guy says, well, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine.
Right,
you
know? Yeah.
Well, Lucas goes to this photographer's studio.
Mm-hmm.
He's an older fellow and very, very eccentric and a very interesting actor. There's a lot we can say about this actor.
I was wondering what the background, or have we seen him before, or is he?
We have not seen him before, but he's apparently a very well regarded Spanish actor. The actor playing Moses is very good, and his role throughout the film is quite intriguing. We've not seen him in anything else, unfortunately, but he agrees to quote unquote take a passport picture for him. Now. Mm-hmm. He asks what would be a natural question to ask somebody who came to you for a passport photo, which is, oh, well, you know, where are you planning to go?
Mm-hmm.
And the lack of forethought on Lucas's part
is like,
very obvious here, where he says, he kind of acts bamboozled. What?
Yeah, he's like, yes.
Well, if you want a passport, if you're getting a photograph for a passport, then I'm assuming that you're going somewhere.
Mm.
And he goes, oh, no, and he just kind of fumbles around with it, but Moses takes the photograph, no big deal, tells him he can come back anytime. And before he leaves, he offers him the product for which this photographer is very obviously making the vast majority of his living, which is photographs of nude women that he takes himself there on the premises.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now she tells him, I'm not interested in that, you know, thank you much, but, you know, I'll come back in a few days to get this photograph. Well, after he leaves, Moses digs out several newspapers and reads all about him. He recognized him.
Yeah,
and he reads about his daughter being hit by the car and killed.
Right.
And he, after reading this, he picks up the phone and makes a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
We see Lucas around town, and it's very clear we're showed that he is being shadowed. The date here is March 29th. He's definitely being followed. He goes to a bar, and while there, he meets a very attractive woman who is a prostitute.
Yes.
Named Angela.
Mm-hmm.
They chat for a very few minutes. She asks him about why he's wearing a black suit. She kind of jokingly says, are you in mourning? And he kind of thinks about it for a second. He goes, actually, yeah, I am.
Mm-hmm.
And she feels apologetic about that, and very quickly they go back to her place.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not unaware at all that she's a prostitute. He knows very good and well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The owner, the madam of the establishment where this lady works, whose name is Concha, played by Elisa Montez, who I don't think we've seen in anything else.
I didn't recognize her name or her.
No. Well, I've seen her in some films. I mean, she was in a couple of spaghetti westerns I've seen, like Texas Adios and things like that. But I don't think we've seen her in anything we've done for the show. I've seen her in a couple of Franco movies, just Franco movies.
Okay.
The girl from Rio, and 99 Women.
I've seen 99 Women, so I would have seen
so her. So she, that, yeah, she, you've seen
she her. She was one that. Of the 99 women then.
Yeah, exactly. When you're in a film with 99
she's
women.
Number 46, yeah. Right?
I don't think they got a number tattooed on them or anything. which is always a possibility yeah. when you're talking about a just Franco.
With Franco, it could
women
have been.
In prison yeah, film. Could, yeah. So it's, yeah, exactly. But she's Concha, the madam and slash owner of the place. And what I think this is a sweet scene because
it's a very well done scene.
This is well played between the actress who's playing Angela. We forgot to mention who she is. That's Blanca Estrada, who is an absolutely gorgeous woman.
Yeah.
Who Nashie has been in several films with. She was in El Caminante for him, and she was the main character in this Spanish jungle girl movie called Kilma, Girl of the Jungle, that Nashie is also in. Wow. Nashie was just an actor, and I think he plays the Great White Hunter role.
Yeah,
in it.
Yeah.
But not been able to see Kilma yet because there is no English language dub of it, which is bizarre when you think about a jungle girl movie that there's no English dub of.
Yeah, exactly. You'd think that would be one that they would have tried to have gotten over here into the drive-in circuit or something, you know, would have been...
Surely.
Well, there's that one, and there's the Tarzan movie he made that we got to hunt down someday too. You know, the Tarzan and King Solomon's Mines or whatever. You know, did as well. So, which I also have no idea if that's those are two we're gonna have to try and hunt up here.
Well, at any rate, Blanca Estrada is an absolutely gorgeous girl. I mean, just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Mm-hmm. She and Lucas go back to her place in the. The bordello, let's call it what it is, and they talk, and it's very obvious that she's a prostitute. There's no question at all. And I love that he says to her, "I'm old enough to be your father."
Mm-hmm.
They talk for a while, and I can see some symbolism in this, but I don't know if in Spanish culture this is some big thing. She suggests that they smoke a cigar together. They actually smoke a cigar. Yeah. Which I don't think is a very feminine thing, but then again, I don't know the Spanish culture, so I don't know if the smoking of the cigar has some significance in Spain that it doesn't necessarily for us.
Yeah, but that is an interesting, you're right, choice that makes there.
And that runs throughout the film for the two of them, so I'm not really sure what the deal is there. But what's neat is he lays down on the bed, she goes to quote-unquote clean up and get undressed, but he calls her over and ends up just pulling her into bed and holding her. And they sleep together. They're there in bed all night, completely clothed.
Yeah. Well, one thing I think he does that's so, I thought, really very effective, and is the way, like, when he pulls her in and she snuggles up against him and he's smelling of her hair. I think at that point it's very obvious that right now he's seeing her as a young girl, like his daughter. You know, he's seeing connections with that whole line about I could be your father, and the fact that he's smelling, I think it's reminding him of just something he hasn't been able to do since his daughter died, which was just to hug her, and I thought that's just a really sweet scene, very moving scene.
I think you're right. The next morning he gets up, he pays her, but she says, she kind of waves him off, but he pays her anyway, and he says, "You've got to understand, you've helped me very much by letting me share my loneliness with you."
Yeah, yeah.
Which is another one of those, just a really sweet moment where you realize this, he wasn't looking at her as a sexual creature. He just wanted some human contact with someone that he could essentially not feel embarrassed or nervous around.
Right.
Whereas he was very obviously going to feel nervous around anybody in that boarding house.
Right. So, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, he leaves there and starts walking around Madrid, and we see him watching... what looked to be parade preparations where they're
people getting ready to hang up banners and things like that.
They're erecting a bandstand and a stage along a particular thoroughfare. He goes back to the boarding house and looks over his pistol and is once again concentrating on the date of May the 1st.
Mm-hmm.
He's cleaning the pistol. He's trying a shoulder holster. He's going through all these different scenarios in his head. The next date we see is April the 1st.
Mm-hmm.
There's a military parade of some type, and I'm not sure what April the 1st signifies. And apparently, these are done every year. Everybody knows about them. Mm-hmm. These various parades are apparently structured throughout the year, and they're these national events, and they're televised. The people at the boarding house are sitting in front of the television watching this parade, and we learned that Lucas has gone there in person, which, of course, the the older fascist thinks, ah, of course he's a very patriotic man, yeah, another himself.
Yeah.
And Lucas is there. He's watching through binoculars. He's watching General Franco, mm-hmm, watching the parade and speaking. And this is another instance of really good use of stock footage. This is very well matched.
Yeah, yeah, it really is.
And at this point, we see Lucas definitely is being actively followed by someone in a car, almost stalled.
Well, I was going to say, what's so funny is they make no effort to hide the fact that they're trying to. I mean, they're very obviously, they don't, you know, they're very obviously letting him know that he's being followed. They're not trying to, they almost hit him a couple of different times, and they're not being subtle about it at all.
He goes back to Moses' photography place to get his photo.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of funny because he interrupts Moses photographing these like four gorgeous nude women in his back room.
Yeah.
Well, Moses scoots him along and sends him back into this little alcove and pushes him in there where he meets three men who've been sitting there waiting for him.
Yeah.
Now, these appear to be men, Basque separatists, or members of the ETA, one of the radical groups, one of the rebellious groups within Spain. They sit him down and tell him, look, we know what you're planning. It's obvious to us. Mm-hmm. And both we and you want the same thing.
Yeah.
You want to kill Franco. Mm-hmm. Now, Lucas is pissed because he thought he was keeping this under wraps. Nobody knew about this. He'd not spoken to anyone about it or anything, and yet they still figured it out. And one of the beautiful things about this movie and about this story is that it's clear that there are so many people who have tried so many occasions to kill Franco that it becomes pretty easy to spot a loner who comes to Madrid with the idea of, I'm going to plug that son of a bitch from here, you know? That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they're talking to him, they say that, look, for the plan to work, the plan's got to be perfect. Let us help you. Let us give you whatever you need.
Yeah.
Let us make suggestions, give you advice. And when it's over, let us take the credit. And if you let us take the credit, we'll give you anything you want, help you get out, help you get away, everything like this. And he is pissed. He completely refuses because he says, my reasons for doing what I'm doing are personal.
Right.
They're not political.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about it and you realize, we've been watching this guy go through these preparations and it's become very clear what he wants to do. And there isn't a political thought in his head about it.
No. And again, it's part of what we see with this movie is... You know, he's both sides. I mean, neither side comes off looking very well. Of these political factions here, come off looking very well in this film. You know, I mean, they don't. You know, and you think about it, like, it's interesting the choice that his character makes in the other movie, because really, he could have just as easily turned his murderous rage against the left wing or against the radicals, because it was their assassination attempt that caused his daughter's death.
Correct.
So I think that the focusing on Franco is basically because he's an easy target in the sense that...
I can find him.
He's somebody that I can take my rage out on, because how is he going to take it if he directed it? But he could have easily directed that rage as much against the radicals as he did against Franco, you know?
Exactly.
And I think that's really interesting that he makes that choice there, or you know... Franco just becomes a symbol for all of his loss, you know? He's not killing Franco because he's politically opposed to him. He's killing Franco because, you know, he just sees him as you know, representative of...
All these things have been taken away from him. Exactly. Well, he refuses. Lucas refuses.
Yeah.
But they say, look, think it over, and they give him a passport. A passport with his photograph and everything. Essentially a passport that would be, he could get out of the country very easily with this thing. Well, back at the boarding house, the young radical, it's dinner time, and he reads a Walt Whitman poem aloud. This just pisses off the old fascist because he assumes that this is some kind of radical radical writer. He's like, it's Walt Whitman.
It's a good humor. Yeah, I thought that was a pretty funny scene.
And I love that because it's one of those demonstrations that I think you occasionally need in this world, where it's possible to interpret any bit of art in any way that you want.
Exactly.
It's whatever you bring to the art that allows you to interpret it in whichever way you intend to do so. Mm-hmm. So of course, over dinner at the boarding house, we have another fight. I just refer to it as another dinner fight. The older fascist attacks. He asks Lucas how his work is coming, because he's always in his room alone working on something. This upsets Lucas something terrible, because He just feels, you know, he feels like somebody's watching him. Somebody's got to be watching him. Obviously, he's just paranoid. And he just gets up and leaves.
Wait, before he does, he takes his fork and bends it.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious because the whole rest of the scene, the old man, Gonzalito, is trying to starts trying to bend his fork, his spoon his, or fork, whatever, and he can't do it. He's just, it's a great little thing that he's in the background. He's the whole time, he's like trying to bend it and he can't.
Well, he leaves the boarding house and goes back to the bar where he met Angela.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not there. And as he's coming out of the bar, he walks right into this burgeoning fist fight right outside the bar, mm-hmm. and gets caught up in it and gets whacked in the head with a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And he stumbles away from the fight as people start blowing whistles and calling for the cops, staggers around the corner and collapses.
Yeah.
And what I thought was neat is as he's staggering around there, you realize this looks just like where Angela took him to where the bordello is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he collapses, and when he wakes up...
Well, before we do, let's just point out that you get a quick glimpse of Alfonso watching all this.
Yes.
Just a quick scene.
Alfonso's witnessed
this whole time, has witnessed what's happened. Doesn't come to his aid. He doesn't know Alfonso's there, but he's been standing there watching this all the whole time that Nash is getting beaten up.
And this should be the moment where you realize this is the guy
who
has been watching Nashy,
who,
even if Moses hadn't done something, this is the guy who sent him to Moses. Mm-hmm. This is the guy who has ties to the underground and to the rebels and to the people trying to take out Franco. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Lucas wakes up, he's in Angela's bed again with a bandaged head,
mm-hmm.
and she explains that we found you collapsed in the doorway outside. She explains that La Concha is just fine with this. You can stay here. And actually, she comes in and speaks to him and makes it clear that she is just fine with this, no problem. Mm-hmm. And it's at this point that the lovely Angela disrobes, showing her insanely gorgeous body.
Amazing body. Yes,
and
yes.
climbs into bed with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, no matter what you think at this point, it's really hard to disagree with what happens next. Which is, of course, they have sex.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love that she even says, wait a minute, aren't you injured? She's kind of joking with him. Not that injured. Now, I'd like to stop for just a second here and point out that Angela, as interesting a character as she becomes in this film,
mm-hmm.
and she is a cliche in a lot of ways.
The hooker with the heart of gold.
Exactly, the hooker with the heart of gold. And mm-hmm. it's, I won't say...
Well, all these hookers are very happy. This is a very happy hooker house.
They are.
None of these girls seem to, they're all like, they're like all sisters, this little family here that Concha's running here, you know. She even talks about Concha sees all the girls there as her daughters, you know. And
well, I mean, later on we see her throwing a birthday party. And they see... It's very odd. It's kind of a very rose-colored glasses view of a bordello in Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Maybe they are happy, and maybe the hookers are happy in Madrid. I don't know. It is a very gloss.
But it struck me as quite mm-hmm. odd in that the film is playing a little bit in caricature with a lot of the characters. I mean, mm-hmm. because they're kind of painting with broad strokes mm-hmm. the various characters in the boarding house.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the most broad-stroked character, the hooker with the heart of gold. It's a freaking cliche.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's a good performance
mm-hmm.
from
mm-hmm.
Mrs. Stroud.
Sure, yeah.
But it is still mm-hmm. kind of a cliche character.
And I first... When this first happened, the scene right here, I was a little disappointed because I found it more interesting, the thought of him seeing her as a surrogate daughter, but at the same time, the more the film goes on, you realize that really she's bringing him back to himself. She's like kind of, and when he's beginning to live again, he's becoming a man again, as far as like with you know, and then suddenly the dynamic between him changes and he sees her as a sexual woman and not as daughter. But at first it was kind of more interesting to me, the fact that I thought that might be a cool way that they were drawn together, is the fact that it's more of it would become more of a father-daughter relationship, you know, instead of a sexual one. So, you know, so at the moment when this happened, I was kind of like, I was less interested in going that way, except that I got to see her naked, which was always good.
Which is always good. Well, the strange thing to me is that when he meets her, he's well aware of the fact that she's a prostitute,
mm-hmm.
but he sees her as an innocent.
Yeah, yeah.
And then once their relationship becomes sexual, they move from, it's the old virgin, mother, and whore, which are the three stereotypical views of women.
Right.
And in this, he starts out kind of having two of them combined in the way he views her, which is he knows she's a prostitute. There's never any question.
Yeah.
And yet he sees her as an innocent. He kisses her on the forehead.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just holds her fully clothed all night. He has absolutely, he doesn't even see her as a sexual creature, even though he knows her, she's a prostitute. It's very clear. And then as their relationship progresses, he eventually proposes marriage to her.
Yeah.
Therefore, you have all three of the of the kind of classical stereotypical views of man, of women, and they're all there. And it's almost as if that's the path he has to take. It's almost like he has to go, he has to follow that path back to himself through these visions of women. Because think about it, he's mourning, what he's really mourning is not just his daughter, but also his wife.
Yeah.
So those two characters kind of join together in grief in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And then coming back to himself. In other words, trying to work through that horrible, horrible grief of the loss of the two most important women in his life to being a human being again, being able to do something different, of having a life again. It's it doesn't need to be read or seen that way, but it's very obviously there.
And all this stuff that's happening to him is in direct, like, throwing up basically a direct conflict to what he is planning. And we'll just say that at this point right now.
Very, very, very true, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, after they have sex, there's a good bit of pillow talk between the two of them. And I thought this was interesting. He says, while it looks like you belong to everyone, you really belong to no one.
Yeah, yeah.
And she says, can a whore belong to someone? He says, if she feels alone, she can. And this is when, this very obviously touches her. She's feeling a connection to him, and they really are communicating in a deep and serious way. And she talks about how she's never seen the sea. And he's really surprised by this. He thinks, okay, look, I can't stay here forever.
Yeah.
But she goes and speaks to La Concha, and she says it's okay, it's just fine. So he's going to just take up residence here with her. He goes back.
You always wonder how that was going to work, considering that generally girls in a brothel are intended to bring in income, and is like, how is that going to work with them? I mean, we never see Angela entertain anyone else since Adesso was Concha basically just writing off one of her girls because she's found love. It's like, wow, that's very sweet of you, madam. You know,
and this is never clear. Does she just start charging him rent?
Yeah, rent, which is
which is very possible, but it's never discussed.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, he goes back to the boarding room, packs up all his stuff, and leaves.
He's just about to leave. He's saying goodbye to everybody, and he gets a phone call.
That's true. Flora's sad to see him go, but as he's about to leave, there's a phone call, and on there is a male voice, and he says, do you remember what happened on, and I can't remember the name of the street. The fight on the street. He says, well, you know, next time we can make it worse. Well, this freaks him out. He slams the phone down and leaves. Well, next we see April the 10th, and it's Angela's birthday. They're in the brothel. They've got a cake with candles on it, the whole nine yards. It's very sweet. It's very obvious these people really are kind of like sisters.
Right.
And Lucas is there. He's kind of, I don't know, he's like the pet guy who lives in the brothel, I guess.
He's not wearing black anymore. That's kind of pointed out there.
He's definitely dressing in less formal and less grieving clothes, shall we say. He gives her a couple dozen roses for her birthday. And I thought this was interesting, too. They start to... It is her birthday. It's very obvious that he wants to make love. But she says, it's just, you know, isn't it terrible that I'm on my period? And he essentially says, so what? And it's clear that they make love, even though she's on her period. And I wonder again if that's another, if that's a major taboo in Spanish culture, or if that's some kind of, is it a Catholic thing or anything of that nature? Because I've never known that to be, I mean, don't get me wrong, I understand.
Sure, yeah.
But I thought it was interesting to have that pointed out and it be a point of dialogue.
I do, yeah. Wow, yeah. It's like, why would they have her say that? Because it doesn't really otherwise play plot-wise in anything else that happens. Yeah. So why would they do that? Yeah, that's something that was interesting. Yeah, it is. I'm not sure what exactly to make of that.
Well, I love this. I love the next scene. It's April the 16th, and it's Holy Week. Being a Catholic country, it's Holy Week. And I'm not Catholic enough to even know what the hell this.
Me either. I don't know what all that entails. Yeah,
but all the hookers are sitting around. There's no work for the hookers.
Nobody's coming to the brothel. Suddenly everybody's repenting that week, and so, you know.
Which I just thought was hysterical. Well,
that was great.
Lucas and Angela are using this this night. It's kind of a date night. They're out at a restaurant that kind of overlooks the city. It's at night. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I know what. I'll take you to the sea. And he takes her out on a rowboat in this lake.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful. What's interesting is that, once again, we're shown that while they're doing what they're doing out in the rowboat, just playing around, they're being watched. Mm-hmm. So you never get too far along without being reminded that there are people keeping tabs on what's going on.
Right.
All right. The next date we are shown is April the 19th, and this is where Lucas visits the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
He has his pistol in this bag that he's carrying around. He visits a bathroom stall, and he's obviously going through some preparations. He's looking around. He's making sure of things. He notices a storeroom window that is something that he's paying specific attention to. He's timing himself walking from one place to another. And while in the bathroom, he pulls out of the bag a uniform and tries it on. And this is where I say... Mm-hmm. I think we get a glimpse into his past.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's this uniform. This uniform is not something that you just pick up someplace. And the movie doesn't make anything special out of him trying to track this thing down. It's very obvious.
Right.
This is something he owns. This is his.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in the military. Mm-hmm. And from that uniform, he may have made it to a certain high rank in the military.
And he might have actually been part of a fascist regime too.
Yes, he may well have been. While doing all this... He is obviously being watched, and after he's leaving the stadium, he's done what he feels like doing. He is picked up by these people who have been watching him in a car.
Yeah.
They pick him up and take him blindfolded on a very long drive out of the country.
Right.
Out of the woods to this shack. They sit him down, let him unblindfold himself, and it's the same people he was talking to at Moses's several weeks before. Why are you carrying the gun around?
Yeah.
And he says, I'm practicing.
Yeah.
They say, you know, they ask to take a look at the pistol. And they universally decide, this is a piece of crap.
Yeah. It's like when people saw the Millennium Falcon, you know, you came in that thing, you know. It's like, this is like, you're going to assassinate Franco with that thing. Basically that thing, yeah. Yeah.
They hand him a case with a rifle in it and say, you should use this instead. And it's broken down. It's you would have to assemble it, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're talking to him and trying to get him to go along with their plan. Let us help you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're talking to him and they're saying, look, they're going to call you a madman. But if we claim your actions,
if a madman kills Franco, it doesn't do any good. Nothing. It just makes him a martyr or whatever, or just doesn't. It doesn't even say. Yeah,
it doesn't mean anything. But if we claim it, then it becomes important. And he's still insistent that no, I don't want any help from you. This is something I'm intending to do. This is personal to me. This has nothing to do with you, and I don't want you involved.
Here we have my favorite line in the whole movie.
Which is?
With the guy, when he says, I want to do this alone. He says, my motivations, I don't believe in your politics. My motivations are personal. And the guy says, everything personal is political in Spain. Yeah. That is my favorite line in the movie. And while we can say more about this later, because Elena has sort of enlightened me onto that statement too. But the first time I heard it, I thought that's absolutely brilliant. I thought that was an incredible line.
And it is interesting when you think about, that's true not just in Spain.
No.
That's true everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, maybe it's more true when you're living under a fascist dictatorship.
Yeah.
Some kind of regime that so harshly tamps down on the natural human impulse to do what the natural human wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. To pinpoint that line is a good place to go. You're right.
Mm-hmm. And they cut up the ante in this scene now.
They do. Well, they say, we like your plan. We like the date and the place you've chosen. It all looks good. And we're just going to be your backup.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he says, what are you talking about? What kind of backup? And he says, well, that's for us to know and you not to worry about. But it's just a car partner at the stadium where the general's car will pass with 25 kilograms of plastic. So if you don't get it, he'll still be gotten. Uh-huh. But he's insistent that they don't. That he's afraid for a moment they're going to do this without him, and he says, "You've got to let me try."
Yeah.
They assure him, "Yeah, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. You get your shot, but we're going to take care of it if you don't." And this is where they up, as you say, up the ante with a quote unquote security measure.
Yeah.
They hand him a photograph of Angela.
Yeah.
Pointing out, we know all about her. We know where you live. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, angers him. He insists, "You got to leave her. You leave her alone." He said, and they just essentially look at him and say, "Look, you've got to think about it. If you decide something, you can go to the photographer. Tell Moses he can get word to us."
Yeah.
But after today, you've only got two people to think about. That girl, Angela, and Franco.
Yeah.
Well, they drop him off in the middle of nowhere.
Basically to practice.
With the weapon, And he sits there with the sniper rifle and starts practicing. Mm-hmm. Next scene, we see him back in the bordello talking with Angela. And he's a little preoccupied, and she's noticed and is concerned. She knows, and they've talked a few times at this point in the film about how she's curious as to what made him come to Madrid. Mm-hmm. And he's not confided in her, and essentially told her, "Look, it's better if you don't know." Mm-hmm. He says, "Look, my life before you was a desert. It was vulgar. It was mediocre. But everything will change soon." And he asked her at this point, "Would you like to go to the sea with me?" Referencing her wish to see the sea, the fact that she's never seen it and how she regrets that. She's kind of caught up and emotional, and he flat out asks her, "Would you marry me? Would you marry a man like me?"
Mm-hmm. She thinks, of course, at first that he's just teasing her, making fun of her.
And they're doing a lot to point out that she's very young. She's clearly in her 20s. Mm-hmm. He's in his 40s. Mm-hmm. Maybe 50s. Mm-hmm. And she says to him, don't make fun of me. Don't ask a question like, "Will you marry me?" Don't make fun of me. And he takes a ring off of his finger, which is one of, I'm not sure if it was his wedding ring or what it was, and puts it on hers. And he says, I'm not kidding. I'm being completely serious. Mm-hmm. And this is the point where you realize these two people really are happy together. They really could make a life together. Mm-hmm. And, but she says to him, you're going to do something important, and I can see that, I can understand that. And she accepts it. Mm-hmm. And he basically gets the idea across to her that once I've done what I'm going to do, we're going to go away. We're going to leave. We're going to go to the sea. As a matter of fact, the further away, the better. Mm-hmm. He goes to Moses, tells him, "Look, tell them I agree, but I have one more demand. I need a passport for Angela." And Moses is like, "I can't get a passport for somebody that fast." Mm-hmm. Bootleg things. "I can't get this done that fast." And and Lucas threatens him. He says, "No, you'll get it done."
Right.
Well, Moses calls and just basically says everything is moving forward without a hitch.
And it almost makes you feel like Moses' whole resistance was kind of fake to begin with, and now because he instantly calms down and is like, "Okay, everything's
moving forward without a hitch." Yeah. What we see next is April the 26th. Mm-hmm. A package arrives at the bordello for Lucas. Inside is the passport for Angela and a big wad of cash. Mm-hmm. Well, he seems a little upset at the cash, but he stuffs it back down in there anyway. Mm-hmm. We see him go to the stadium on just a normal day when there's nothing really going on there, and he's looking around with binoculars. He looks again at the storeroom. It's obvious he's making practice runs. And next up is May 1st, mm-hmm. which is a big day. Apparently, it's the Labor Day celebration. And I think here we're going to break away from what we normally do in this podcast, which is spoil the holy living crap out of the movies.
Right.
And I've kind of thought that it might be a good idea to not spoil this film and let this be a film that I hope people seek out. We're not going to spoil the end of this. We're not going to go through the details of the last 15 to 20 minutes of this movie, because I think it's best left up to each person who watches this movie to discover it on their own. I think if you're a Nashi fan, I think you'll like this movie, and that's why I think we're going to leave this the way it is and back away from it and not talk too much about the ending. And I think that at this point, maybe we start discussing it in more general and broad terms, so we can talk about our impressions of the movie, what we felt about it, and things of that nature without spoiling the end
a little bit. Yeah.
So I know we talked a little bit about it before we started recording, Troy, but...
If you like this new thing we're doing here, let us know, and we'll do it more. If you don't like it, if you want us to continue on to the end of films and it pissed you off that we didn't spoil it out, then let us know that,
too. Let us know that, too, yeah.
If you're indifferent, you know...
just roll.
Just as long as we make fools of ourselves, you don't care what we talk about, then yeah.
As long as we sound like total morons, it's all good. Who cares? Well, yes. Troy, I'd like to know. We talked a little bit about it before, but what do you think of The Sniper?
I really, really enjoyed it. I was very, very impressed. It's been a while since we had a really nice surprise along this level. You know, in the last... year that we've been doing these films, predominantly ones we haven't seen. You know, obviously, we knew Nigh the Werewolf was a winner. We'd both seen that before. But the majority of these films have been ones that neither of us have seen. And we've had some that turned out, to be better than we thought they were, maybe initially thought they were going to be. That have been some nice surprises. But nothing on the level of an El Caminante or a Frenchman's Garden. And I wouldn't say that about this film, but I feel like this is kind of the first gem that we've had in a while, as far as like a film that I truly enjoyed. It's a not a perfect film. I do have to ask you this. Once again, we can't talk about the ending or the rest of the film. We talked about him as he was going through his preparations. Lucas, he dresses in a military uniform. Do you know what where that was supposed to come into play? Or we may not be able to say, but he doesn't really. He never dressed that way again. Well, and I was a little confused as to what happened.
Think that it was a part of his initial getaway plan.
Okay. Okay.
In other words, no one's going to suspect someone who's there as part of the, as part of the military.
Okay.
So I think that he thought that he could put on the uniform, do what he was going to do, and then leave without drawing too much attention to himself because of the uniform.
Okay. Okay. Well, that was one part that I'd gotten a little confused about, but I think I think the film's very engrossing, very moving. I love the way that it, again, doesn't really take sides. It kind of keeps the focus. I mean, Lucas remains, true to, or what he wants to try and do. He doesn't allow himself, like I said, his motivations are not political. Both regimes, both sides don't come off looking very well in the film. I think it makes it kind of plain what a oppressive society people were living in. Obviously, the people you like are the people who are just being themselves in the film, whether they're the whores or the people at the boarding house or whatever. They're just, basically the people who are just living, and that's the way it is that most of the people are just living their everyday lives, just wanting to watch TV and eat, and survive, and
have a life.
Exactly. And I think that I don't know what else this director did. I know Nashi himself said he thought it was the director's best work. I don't know how many other films or what else he did, but...
Well, he only did a few other films, and I think maybe now the time is to read some more of Nashi's thoughts on the film.
That's good.
This is from his biography, or his autobiography, pardon me. He says, the film narrates the story of Lucas, a Basque watchmaker who loses his daughter in a terrorist bomb attack. Lucas is a widower, decides to assassinate the head of state whom he considers responsible for his tragic loss. Armed with a 9mm pistol, he heads for Madrid to draw up a plan for the assassination of Francisco Franco during a Labor Day rally held in the Santiago football stadium. Exercising the utmost caution, he takes a room in a boarding house run by a sympathetic middle-aged lady. The other guests are a motley bunch, including an elderly fascist, a young trendy, and an over-the-hill bohemian. The well-endowed young maid is most accommodating to any of the guests who take her fancy. ETA, that's the terrorist group, knows all about the amateur executioner's plans and decides to utilize him, preparing a car bomb to back up just in case he fails. Lucas falls in love with a ravishing prostitute, bringing an unexpected glimmer of hope for the future to the lives of both of these marginal characters. But first he has to achieve his aim, to kill Franco. I think The Sniper was a good movie, full of suspense, well-paced, wonderfully acted, and with a surprisingly skillful use of documentary footage intercut with the fictional action. It was the only real quality film that director Carlos Puerta made in his brief career. And then he goes on to praise the cast. Mm-hmm. I believe I gave a highly credible performance as the wretched Lucas, the watchmaker turned terrorist. While we were filming, there were violent riots going on in the streets, which the notorious Greys, the Spanish National Police of Franco's regime, was known as the Greys. They put these riots down ruthlessly. We were going through the most tense, conflictive time of the transition. It was then that the nightmare began. The telephone, at times an infernal contraption, kept ringing at all hours, conveying a message of death. Horrible, threatening voices at all hours of the night. And then he goes on to relate how he had to send his family away.
Right.
He was convinced for a while that somebody was going to kill him.
What's really excruciating there is he said that at one point they made him sing a pro-Franco song over the phone, basically, yeah. You know, as it, because they were threatening his family, so he had to sing a song that was kind of the anthem of the Franco regime.
Yeah, yeah, and like I say, I'm glad even at that point in time, well, he wrote the book in the late 90s, he could see that it was a good film,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But obviously he paid a high price, yes. Professionally,
mm-hmm.
For this, and this is, of course, another one of those bumps along his career road, mm-hmm. that kind of made life more difficult for him as time went on. Mm-hmm. He never was particularly well thought of or well
respected, I guess,
at all. Yeah, yeah, in his home country.
Mm-hmm.
And this film will be another one of those that caused him problems, which is a shame, in that it is such a well produced and well done movie.
It is. I love some of the touches sound wise in the film. The dripping water when he said we never talked about that.
In his room at the boarding room.
A dripping tap has been used many times in films for many different purposes. And here I think it's just kind of like showing once again the focus of his mind. You know, it echoes the clocks. You know, that he works on. It's just basically that kind of just at that point he's. And of course, when he leaves the boarding house, he's kind of leaving that clockwork life, kind of leaving that, you know, that, and that all kind of falls into the transition his character goes through. And again, this won't give anything away about the ending, but just say one of the main things about this film that's important to the whole story is that he starts his mission as an automaton, basically a robot who's dead inside, you know, and going about perfectly about his, and by the time he gets to the day, his big day, where he's got to do what he's got to do, he's become a human being again. And that all figures in very much into the ending, you know, how the film plays out.
Right, right. He's become someone who can feel again,
mm-hmm.
whereas once we have that outburst of rage after mm-hmm. the funeral of his daughter,
right.
He has shut himself down emotionally.
Yeah.
He gives himself a task.
Yeah.
And he shuts himself down emotionally, and the whole idea that he has is to just do it.
Yeah.
And he sets about doing it. But he falls in love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he becomes someone who can feel again.
Yeah.
Where it's very obvious that after the death of his daughter, he was convinced that his life really was over.
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't think, mm-hmm. he didn't really think when he started mm-hmm. planning out what he was going to do,
mm-hmm.
that he was going to survive this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This was, I almost wanted to say, this was death by dictator.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right.
He was going to do this, mm-hmm. and he knew he was going to die. I think this is a very good film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a great film. It's mm-hmm. not one of his best. No, I think you're right. I don't think it reaches the heights of El Caminante or the Garden of the Frenchman.
Mm-hmm.
Either one. Those are better movies.
Mm-hmm.
But this is still a very good film.
It is.
And I think Nashie gives a very good performance. There are moments that are very quiet, nuanced moments that are really impressive from him.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the same kind of stuff that you could see from him in performances like in Hunchback of the Morgue and things of that nature. You see that kind of work here as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are moments when you see a burying of the soul here. You mm-hmm. see a man trying desperately to come to grips with warring emotions within himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a fine job here. The surrounding cast is also good. There are The flaws in the film, I think, are in those things that make you start to question the background of some of the characters, why they are the way they are, and just some of the there aren't any plot holes in the story at all.
Right.
There's nothing of that nature. It's just you start to question you start to question the motivations of certain characters, not the terrorists, not any of the movers and shakers, but just people.
Well, like you said, some of the stuff with the hookers and everything is just a little too
exactly
rosy, just a little too maybe needed a little more grit there, to make it a little more convincing,
I agree. And those are the areas where I think the film, it fails.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's less focused, less well rounded, less well written to a certain degree, because certain other areas of it are so sharply drawn that those kind of stand out, especially when you're going back through it and you're thinking about, wow, this worked, but not all of it worked. These pieces didn't work as well as these others.
Yeah,
what's great is that all of the connections and all the character interactions, all those work.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are really nicely done, and they are effective.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Overall, I very much like this film. Mm-hmm. It's another. I'm going to chalk this up as another great little discovery from his resume.
I agree. And like I said, the first one in a while that's been that nice of a surprise, that big of a surprise that I was really that impressed with. I actually gave it an 8. Yeah, that was
really good. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. You went that high. I ended up giving it a 7.
Mm-hmm.
We're not far apart on this one. I have to admit, this is a good movie. And we've said this about several films from Nashi that don't have English dubs. This is a film, along with El Caminante and The Frenchman's Garden, that I wish Criterion or somebody of that nature would get their hands on.
I know.
Do an English translation. Yeah. Do subtitles.
Yeah. Yeah.
And bring out, because these are the types of films that I think an art house crowd, a film crowd, would really get behind, would really enjoy. This has got to be when I think about the three films we're talking about there, El Caminante, Frenchman's Garden, and this.
Mm-hmm.
These are movies that are just not well known
in
film nerd circles.
No, they're really not.
When you start talking about the crowd of people who are real film fanatics, this is right up their alley, man.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
And if they could just see them, I mean.
Even horror snobs would get into. I mean, or people who don't normally do horror movies or think they're beneath them. Even just people they'd love these films. These films are more.
It's like I think it's a shame, and it just makes me wonder just how many other things like this are out there. Not just in looking at Nashi's career, but when you look at a film like this and you say, "Wow, man, this is the kind of movie that I think film snobs could really get behind," but. How are they even going to know about it?
Wouldn't it be interesting to take someone who was a huge film fan, didn't know much about horror movies, and show them, say, I want to show you something about this Spanish, from the Spanish actor, filmmaker, Paul Nashi, and you showed them in El Caminante,
Frenchman's Garden,
this, Naked Madrid, what if you showed them those before you showed them Night of the Werewolf or Horror Rises from the Tomb or something, wouldn't that be interesting to see?
Oh wow! Yeah, I mean that would be fascinating because they would be able to they'd see this guy making serious films, different types of roles and different types of stories, and then they would see him transform into a werewolf and rip somebody's throat out.
Well, I think my last thoughts I wanted to say on this film is that once again this watching this film I was just struck again by what a fascinating figure. And how worthy of attention Paul Nashi's career is in his career and what I think why he's heroic to me in a lot of ways sometimes because he's just we love all of our classic horror stars but again the reason why he's the one that's so fascinating to talk about is because what other horror star would make three transgressive controversial, political-based or satirical films or whatever in a row, he did. Plus, he also did Naked Madrid, which Naked Madrid got him in trouble, too, because, it's a satire of the film industry and satire of a lot of some of the same things that...
Some of the same things
that this film does more seriously.
Society, yeah.
Would do that and then turn around and run around in graveyards and dressed as a werewolf. The closest I can think of is, I do know Boris Karloff was one of the original, the group that founded the Screen Actors Guild when they had their very first meetings to create the Screen Actors Guild. Yeah. Boris Karloff was in on that, but otherwise, none of the other horror stars got into this kind of world at all, you know. And with Nashi, I just think it's a fascinating thing, that the things he chose to do. And once again, get back to the fact that, again, he chose to be, you know, he enjoyed playing horror. He enjoyed playing monsters more than those guys did, too, you know, and then the other classic horror stars did, you know.
Probably so. Well, listen, we talked a little bit about how we elicited some information from our friend of Madrid, Elena,
mm-hmm.
and she wrote us a lengthy email here, and I wanted to go ahead and read this out just for more background information about this film and some little tidbits about mm-hmm. Spain and Spanish culture that kind of help someone understand this film who's not a part of Spain.
Yeah, yeah, she helped us out. This is great what she gave us here, a little material to go on.
Now, some of what she lays out here, I'm going to admit, it reiterates some things we've already talked about, because mm-hmm. we both read this email and kind of absorbed it and made it a part of what we're discussing right. as we go along. But I want to read this whole thing out, because I think there are things here that I think people will appreciate. She says, The Sniper is a very hard film for Nashi, as after doing it, he started receiving calls and threats from extreme right ideological people. The movie was made 2 years after Franco passed away. The movie does not go very deep into the ideology or of the terrorism. During the dictatorship, there were many attempts to kill Franco, even during a soccer match in 1964. It was in 1958 when the terrorist band ETA started, and in 1973 they killed Carrero Blanco, a Spanish admiral and longtime confidant of Francisco Franco. Within about 6 months of being named prime minister, Blanco was assassinated in Madrid by four Basque members of ETA, who carried out a bombing while he returned from mass. Since Carrero Blanco could have become the most powerful figure in Spain upon Franco's death, his death was perhaps instrumental in the transition toward a democratic government in that country. Then she gave me a link to Wikipedia about some certain things. She says, one of the most famous attempts to kill Franco was the one José Blas Elogo. I'm going to slaughter this name.
No pun intended.
Oh, God. Yeah, no joke. The fellow's name was José Blas Elogoy. He made this attempt in 1970 in the Basque country when he burned himself and threw himself as a kamikaze toward the dictator.
Inventive.
Yeah. Now she says, my two cents, there is still a lot of Franco around us in Spain, beginning with the king. That was an imposition made by Franco, and also many of the people in power nowadays are Franco supporters, but that is another story. When the movie was made, there were really bad times for Spain. The country was going from a dictatorship to a democracy, but nobody knew what would happen. There was also an attempted coup d'etat on February the 23rd, 1981, by Tejero. So just imagine how the country was at the time. I do not know if you need more information about politics, but let me know all the questions. Trust me, Elena, you answered more than we needed.
No, it was fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, then she gave us information about the gray ones, which are the police, mm-hmm. Their gray uniforms. And I had asked some specific questions about the banners that were being hung, the colors, the red and the yellow. And so she clued me in about that. They're symbols of Franco's government. And so I was curious about the use of colors, and that she cleared that up for me. Thank you once again, Elena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was going to say, one of the things I responded to, I told her about how much I loved, as I said before, how much I loved that bit of dialogue about the...
Oh, the personal is political.
About everything that is personal is political in Spain. And if I don't know if you have her response there. Yeah.
She says, the personal is political is a feminist motto from the 1970s, so it may come from that. And she's kind of amused by this. She says, it's also a motto that's still popular today in Spain, especially in left-wing parties and with left-wing people.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting.
And I think it's a truism, so I think it's a universalism,
really. It is, yeah. And I think, you know, again, you know, if she's talking about how you know, what I get from her is that you still got to be careful where you tread politically on the memory of Franco, because you can imagine just 2 years after his death, you imagine what a hotbed, you know, that Nashi was working in.
Yeah.
How many people were there that still had worked for Franco, who worshipped the man, you know, and then there are the people who felt he was the worst thing that ever happened to the country, you know, and you can imagine the very volatile on both sides there, you know. It's
having never, in this country, never having had to deal with living under a dictatorship,
right?
It's kind of hard to imagine what it would be like. I mean, we just don't have the background for it. And so I thought that's why it was important to kind of get Elena to give us a little bit of information. I was very happy to have her giving us some links to different pages, different things to give us an idea of what was going on, not just some specific background on Franco and how long he reigned and when I know the transition was very difficult and it kind of made a lot of lives hellish.
In the
late 70s, and apparently, like you say, you don't rule a country for decades and have the country, you know, kind of shake itself and go off into a democratic governmental system easily.
Right.
And the fact that there's a lot of that still hanging around doesn't really surprise me. It's going to take a few generations before that kind of thing is completely behind a country. But I find it fascinating that a film like this, that so clearly in how it is telling its story, and just listening to the main character's vehement desire to not have his actions interpreted politically, that didn't seem to matter. And it, I wonder if it's one of those cases where these people were reacting to something they didn't even bother to see. They just, you know, had things described to them and were told that it was disrespectful, or that it was that it was left wing propaganda or whatever was being said about it, and that became the rallying cry, and that became the reason they did what they did.
Yeah, you're talking about as in the reaction to the film.
Yeah, the reaction.
Oh, yeah. I mean, God, we know we've seen that in this country with all the people that picketed Last Temptation of Christ without watching the movie. You know. You know, and not realizing what a reverent and moving film it is, and not at all, you know, what they all were led to believe it was, but, you know, rather than see it themselves, they just, you know, went ahead and took somebody else's word for it. And so, yeah, we definitely see how that can happen.
When you get into religious films and religious interpretations of things, you get into some weird areas in my opinion, because you get these, there are a lot of people who actually, and this is part and parcel of a lot of ways people think of religion and their spiritual life. It's almost as if once they're told that something is, shall we say, blasphemous or what, or whatever word or term they want to use toward their religion, they not only don't want to seek it out because they don't want to be insulted or whatever. They almost, there's this ridiculous, almost superstitious fear that if I see it, it may taint me.
It's going to. I know exactly what you know. It's like, how strong is your faith, you know, basically,
right,
you know?
Right, I mean, how can you, are you unable to maintain your own mental processes by are they going to be, are you afraid to have facts presented to you or information or somebody else's point of view because you're afraid that point of view might contradict your own, and that what's it going to do? Make you think a little deeper or harder about what you think?
I mean, well, it's like John Milton, who was, you know, one of the most devout men ever. I mean, he wrote a very powerful anti-censorship, you know, pamphlet, which basically the whole point of it was, if your faith is strong enough, you should not be afraid of knowledge. You should not be afraid of being confronted by other ideas or other, or, you know, by other
belief
writings,
systems,
you know,
or other ways of looking at the world.
Well,
these kind of things, sad to say, these are the kind of things we're not going to solve
around
the table.
It's not going away.
And they're always going to be with us.
That's right.
Nevertheless, once again, the sniper, pretty
check
nice little surprise, worth seeking out. If you have access to the special antenna, I would definitely seek it out.
Yeah, agreed.
Another winner from the 1970s from Mr. Paul Naschy. I would love to know just how much input he really had into the script.
I would too. That question will always probably wonder, and that would be nice to know, like, what were his ideas, and, you know.
Yeah, what did he have influence over in the script? Interesting. I wonder who originally. I bet you this feels like a director generated project. To take that credit at the beginning of the film, I would say that's the case.
Probably so.
Well, we're going to take a quick little break, and then we will come back. And sad to say, we don't have any feedback this time around. The mailbag is pretty low, folks, so it's time for you to get on the ball. But we'll come back in just a few minutes, and we will talk to you about what's coming up next on the NashyCast.
Yeah, when we've heard yet again from several times from the Tool tribute band, but we'd like to hear from you too. You Schism, I'm sure you're an awesome band, and we appreciate you reaching out to us and remind us how awesome you are, but we want to hear from our listeners. So anyway, we'll be back in a moment.
Aquaman, no one greater than Aquaman. the danger is, that's where he'll be. Always defending you, yeah, you and me. Aquaman.
All right, as we said, we don't have any feedback, any email this time around, but then, honestly, we're doing this hard on the heels of the holiday, so I guess it's not that out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
So, folks, get on the stick, write us, nashycast@gmail.com. Drop us a line. Let us know what you think. Let Rod and Troy talk to you. Engage in a dialogue back and forth about Paul Nashy.
If you're listening to earlier episodes, we can still talk about those. You know, it doesn't have to be about the most recent episode.
That's right. Stephen Sullivan, when he sent us that MP3 last time, was talking about wanting to talk about Hunchback of the Morgue, but we'd done the film so long ago, the podcast on that film so long ago, that he thought it would be a bad idea. But no. Yeah. Remember, the whole point of this podcast is to talk about Paul Nashy's films. And we can talk about the first film we covered, the fifth film we covered, any of his films. That's the whole point of this. Mm-hmm. We're always willing to do that. We're always wanting to do that. I mean, that's why we love his movies, is we like talking about them. So, remember, get in contact with us. Drop us an email at nashycast@gmail.com or come on over and visit us on the Facebook page. Talk to us. Ask us questions. Mm-hmm. Record an MP3 and email it to us. Just like Stephen Sullivan. Anything you want to do. We're glad to hear from you. So, I guess that about wraps it up.
Yep.
Unless you've got anything else going on.
Nope. We're going to talk about next time.
Well, that, or we could talk about what we're reading. I'm reading comic books again. No, I really am. It's really kind of bizarre. Yeah. Well, a little bit. I'm reading Aquaman, the new Aquaman stuff, and the new Firestorm comic book. Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to say, I'm actually enjoying what I've read of the new 52. You know, when they did this thing first, I was like, oh, Christ, here we go with the yearly reboot of the DC Universe where everybody to get ranked Excel issued. But actually what they did is not a totally bad idea. And the way it started, I don't know if you read the Flashpoint, the thing that kind of kicked it off.
It's actually
a pretty damn good and not a bad idea. It's not one of those things where you roll your... It wasn't like their normal crisis thing where it's like, okay, here's the major character we're going to kill off and here's the things we're going to do. I mean, it actually was the story made sense. It was very well thought out, and actually it was pretty cool.
Well, here's the thing. The reason I'm reading the Aquaman stuff is I really like the character.
Mm-hmm.
But also, they've just started this multi-part crossover with a Justice League book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm reading that, and I've read the first three issues of this big crossover, and it's really entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really kind of surprised. I dropped away. I've been reading just a bunch of older comics that I get in collections, you know, the big essential collections or the hardbacks when I can get my hands on them and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really quite fun. Here's the really surprising thing. Anybody out there besides me remember Night Force?
Yeah, gosh, vaguely, okay. I do.
It was a short-lived DC Comics supernatural story thing. A supernatural kind of a group brought together by this this character to deal with supernatural things. Marv Wolfman created it along with Ernie Cullen.
Mm-hmm.
Gene Cullen. Who, you know, most people are going to know. Anybody who's a big fan of this kind of stuff is going to know him, of course, from Tomb of Dracula back in the 70s.
Right,
the phenomenal comic book,
amazing
Tomb of Dracula.
Novel, yeah.
And what's really great is Wolfman, along with artist Tom Mandrake, because, of course, Gene Cullen's passed away.
Right.
He did a seven-issue miniseries kind of retelling of the Night Force storyline. And I just discovered that this happened last year. And I stumbled across the first two issues of it. Well, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And read the first two issues and immediately went, "Oh, I gotta read the rest of this." So I've got the other issues on their way to me. But oh man, it's just such a surprise. But we should stop talking comics.
Yeah, we should. Well, I know, but I just want to say one more thing. It looks like a part of that New 52. You know, they've got this thing called Justice League Dark, which sounds almost like maybe the same thing where it's like kind of a version of Justice League, but using some of their more supernatural characters, including John Constantine as part of the group.
Really?
And one interesting thing, because I'm a huge Hellblazer fan, it's one of the few comic books that I've continually, like, never dropped reading, even in years when I wasn't really reading any other comic books, I've continually read Hellblazer. Well, Hellblazer's about to end with issue 300. It's pretty amazing it made it to issue 300, but...
I didn't even know it was still going.
It's going to end at 300, and then they're going to start a new Constantine title that's actually going to be not in the Vertigo line, but in the new 52 line, and then he's also a member of this Justice League Dark. But I'm going to be interested to see what happens with, because one of the things about, you know, obviously having it under the Vertigo line, they could get away with pretty much anything under that, and it always has been a very harsh and very cutting edge and dark title. And it's going to be very interesting to me to see what they do with Constantine now that they're kind of shoehorning, kind of fitting him back under their superhero line. I hope that, I mean, I love the character, and it'd be interesting. But that's where he started, of course, started in Swamp Thing, created by Alan Moore. He was created by Alan Moore when Alan Moore was doing his run on Swamp Thing. But anyway, yes, I know this will shock everybody to find out we're geeks. You know, we shouldn't have let that out, should we? We were kept this facade. Yeah, sorry.
We should probably stop.
Forget everything we said. We don't read comic books.
This is not a comic book podcast. Yeah, that's maybe we do a Bloody Pit episode of comic books, but that's enough for now. Anyway. Folks, we just like to say that next issue.
See?
Oh, God.
If you want to subscribe to our podcast and get it to your nice, brown, sturdy mailers.
Yeah, we'll bag and board it.
We'll bag and board. This podcast has been bag and boarded, sir.
Okay. Next episode. Episode 36.
Mm-hmm. 3 years, buddy. We'll be the third year. 3 years we've been doing this.
We're going to zag back to the 21st century and cover another film that Mr. Nashie did in his waning days. Mm. One that we're very excited to finally get to see. One that just a short year ago, I did not know if we'd ever get a chance to see an English version of.
Right.
And that would be 2005's A Werewolf in the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he does not play Valdemar Daninsky.
I don't think he plays a werewolf in this. Or maybe he does, but he's not Valdemar Daninsky. So.
I think he may play multiple characters, but I know he plays a character called Dr. Moreau. So this looks to be a variation on the classic H.G. Wells tell, The Island of Dr. Moreau. So, Werewolf in the Amazon, next time out, 2005. Neither of us have seen it.
Yeah. Now, you said English version, but I'm assuming this is not truly subtitled. It's subtitled. Yeah, yeah. I want to clarify that this is not a dubbed version.
I do believe this is a Brazilian film.
Yeah, right.
So what this is, the Special Antenna has gifted us, thank you, with a subtitled version of Werewolf in the Amazon. We are very excited to get the chance to see this, and I can't wait. I mean, first of all, it sounds interesting and exciting to begin with, just from what little I know about it, and wow. You know, it's kind of a new horror film.
New Nashie horror film, and we won't be having too many horror films left to get to on the show. So it's exciting when we got one. So yeah, so join us. Do what you can to hunt it out, seek it out, and
we will do our best to not spoil that one either. We'll try to talk about it in fairly general terms, although I'm sure we'll discuss some aspects of it in detail, the ones that pique our fancy. We hope it's good.
Yeah, let's hope so.
So, join us if you can for Werewolf in the Amazon next month on the Nashie Cast. And once again, thank you for tuning in. Drop us a line at nashiecast@gmail.com if you can. And once again, thank you for listening. Keep tuning in and let us know what you think. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
See you soon.